From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Xi Jinping of China spoke to President Trump today about the growing global threat of the new coronavirus. She urged Trump to respond reasonably, even as Beijing keeps millions of people under indefinite quarantine in Wuhan, where the outbreak started. There are now more than 31,000 confirmed cases, mostly in China, and more than 630 people have died. The BBC's Stephen McDonald joins us now from Beijing. And Stephen, one of the people who has died in China is the doctor who got into trouble with communist authorities for sounding an early warning about the coronavirus threat. People there are having a tremendous reaction to this. What are you seeing?
Yeah, the death of Dr. Li Wenliang has been heartbreaking for people in this country. But for the Chinese leadership, it's frankly an epic political disaster. And so the Communist Party is having to deal with this, but frankly, they'd have to be blind not to see the flaws in the system which led to this. I mean, in December, he posted on a chat forum with his former university classmates that there'd been an influx of virus patients at his hospital. He thought it was SARS. For that, he not only got hauled over the coals by hospital officials, but police came and detained him and accused him of spreading rumours. Now, he and another 7 or 8 whistleblowers have since been cleared by the Supreme Court here, which have said there's nothing wrong with them, obviously trying to get the word of this virus out. And in fact, if people had only listened in the early stages, perhaps the authorities could have got on top of this problem a lot quicker.
What does it say to you that the Chinese people have been responding so vocally and so publicly online, and that now the Chinese Communist Party says it will investigate this death?
Well, I think that he risked things as he did to try and get the word out. He's punished wrongly. Then he ends up dying because he's treating patients who have the coronavirus. It's just such a terrible story, and I think it has really touched people. Now, the party has no choice but to then say, don't worry, we'll look into this. However, their method of looking into it is to send these anti-corruption investigators from the capital. Now, some critics of the system here would say that's been part of the problem. It's that fear of retribution within the party which has led those police to tell him in the first place you can't go spreading rumours. It's also led, for example, to the mayor of Wuhan to be saying, oh, I'm really sorry I didn't release that information a bit earlier, but I didn't get clearance from above. I mean, this just seems to show a fundamental flaw in the way things are done here.
Stephen, tell me more about the state of this outbreak and in Wuhan, where they have recently built these two new prefabricated hospitals with thousands of new beds. What's the state of the outbreak there, the state of those hospitals? Are they full?
China now, having decided that they've got to do something about this, is throwing everything at the problem. But that's not enough, though. I mean, this is a country with vast resources, and yet we're getting officials in Wuhan saying they don't have enough beds, they don't have enough equipment. I mean, some scientists think that potentially they're only catching 1 in 10 people infected. That's because some people have got the virus, don't have such serious symptoms, and yet they could still end up passing on the virus to others. That's why there's, well, according to some estimations, they're adding another 50,000 infected people every day in Hubei. So, you know, it's a potentially very serious situation.
And I know you've been to Hubei to do some reporting on this. How is it affecting you and your ability to do your job?
Yeah, well, we went into Hubei province and were told sort of on the way in by the police, if you go in there, we're not going to let you back out again. But we sort of pushed on regardless. I mean, inside Hubei, it's just like ghost town after ghost town. People are not on the streets there at all. You can imagine the climate of fear, 60 million people locked down. And then, well, in the end, we were kind of kicked out of there because we're in a small city and there were some officials who decided they'd rather breach their own quarantine rules than have some pesky reporters hanging around their town. And so they got the police and just escorted us back across the border. However, upon returning to Beijing, given that we've been in that worst-hit province, we're now in quarantine, so I'm stuck at home reporting for 2 weeks. And this is the same thing that's happening with anybody who's been in that province, especially in Wuhan. Those returning to the United States or Britain or Australia, Japan, anywhere, they're being placed in quarantine for 2 weeks because of that incubation period.
That's the BBC's Stephen McDonnell, as you just heard, in quarantine in Beijing after he visited Hubei province. Stephen, thanks for the work you're doing. We do appreciate it.
No worries. I'll be liberated in 3 days.
People on Chinese social media are also sharing the song "Do You Hear the People Sing" from the 2012 film version of Les Miserables in remembrance of Dr. Li. It's one example of how residents there are circumventing China's tight controls on free speech. The song is a revolutionary call for people to overcome adversity. For more on this and other news that's playing out on social media, we have with us Femi Ok, the host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. And Femi, along with the posting of that song, Les Mis, from Les Mis, what are the other ways that people, ordinary people really, are getting around China's censors and talking about the coronavirus online?
So much going on Weibo, on WeChat, social media platforms in China. There have been calls for Wuhan to build a statue in Dr. Li's honour. There were images of Dr. Li wearing his face mask. Sometimes across the face mask, there's barbed wire. There's one picture that I saw with a hand gagging him, not allowing him to speak out about the Wuhan virus, the coronavirus. And then also demands for an apology. And that demand for an apology comes in a hashtag. That hashtag has, according to people online in China, been censored. So Go Away With Jay says Chinese netizens are furious. They are demanding an apology for Wuhan government to Dr. Li, created a hashtag for it. Guess what? The government censored this hashtag. Despite the censorship, people are still speaking out. They really feel that Dr. Li is a local hero, and without him, many more people would have died. Without him, again, speaking out on social media.
Yeah, so much developing there. I want to talk about another thing that we're seeing on social media. Gail King of CBS This Morning has been taking some heat after she was criticized in an interview that she did this week about the late Kobe Bryant. Fans took issue because she asked Lisa Leslie, a former WNBA star and a friend of Kobe's, about Kobe's sexual assault case. King responded on the backlash on social media yesterday. What did she say?
So, Gail King posted on Instagram an explanation for why she would ask a friend of Kobe Bryant about Kobe Bryant's sexual assault case, the rape case from all the way back in 2003. The reason this became such a huge story online was because people were seeing just the little promo clip of that section of the interview. They saw that and they were so mad. They hadn't necessarily seen the entire interview. All they saw was Gail King talking to a friend of Kobe Bryant who is in mourning about a case that had been put to rest some while ago, depending on, I use that phrase advisedly because it may depend what you feel about that actual case and Kobe Bryant. So Twitter lit up on this. People were very upset. So to give you some idea, one poster said it would be fitting for Gail King to have such an interview with Harvey Weinstein and ask him questions about his legacy, because Gail King and her good friend Oprah know Harvey Weinstein. They have been friends with him. They have pictures posted with him. All of this is all being shared online. And that girl at the party, in response to Gail King saying, this is why I did the interview. It was important that I asked this question. But Gail King says that she feels that interview was taken out of context. She wouldn't necessarily have used it as a promotion. And the response that we saw and heard you insert the topic into the interview. So not everybody is happy about this. And they feel
it's hard
that
to
the
put
apology
that back in the
is
bottle,
making it worse.
You know, after that promotion has been out, it's hard to like bring that back once
so,
it
Tonya,
becomes
the,
a conversation.
The issue here on social media is, how soon is too soon for journalists to ask those tough questions? Black Twitter in particular is upset that Gail King, as a woman of colour, is actually asking questions about the other members and very high profile members of the black community. And then the idea is, should you apologize if something is blowing up on social media? Should you let it just die down? This story is getting bigger and bigger and bigger because Gayle King is responding, and she's actually responding to her critics online, which almost never happens. She's tweeting backwards and forwards. She's saying, yes, I hear your point. She's having a conversation with her critics.
Mm, and are they responding positively to that?
Some of them are. So it would be remiss of me not to actually say some of the support that Gayle King is getting. The Archangel, for instance, says, Gayle, you did your job well. People don't understand that as a journalist, you must cover every aspect of a story, whether popular or unpopular. You did your job.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll see that continue on throughout. I've seen a lot of those posts already. It's Femi Okeh is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, as always, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Take care.
Women in America have long vied for the highest political office, the presidency. This week on Throughline, how things have changed and not for female presidential candidates throughout American history. Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time to understand the present.
Seven Democratic candidates for president face off tonight in New Hampshire for a debate ahead of the state's primary on Tuesday. Meanwhile, the results of the Iowa caucuses are still a point of contention, even after the Iowa Democratic Party's released of new results late last night. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg have both declared victory, but the Associated Press said it could not declare a winner, citing missing data and apparent errors in how the results were tallied. Let's bring in Anthony Brooks. He's a senior political reporter for WBUR in Boston. And Anthony, let's take Iowa first. Tom Perez, chair of the Democratic National Committee, had called on the state party to re-canvass some of the results in areas where irregularities had been reported. Will that happen, or is the party moving on to New Hampshire now?
Well, a little bit of both, probably. I mean, Tom Perez is calling for a re-canvass in precincts that reported problems, and it's the latest development in this debacle out of Iowa, where there's still no declared winner, as you mentioned. But, you know, it does look like Bernie Sanders, he's leading in the popular vote, while Pete Buttigieg is apparently leading with more state delegate equivalents, according to this weird and strange formula used to calculate that, right? So Iowa has suddenly scrambled the race in New Hampshire, which is looking more and more like a contest between Sanders, the oldest candidate in the race, and the progressive against Buttigieg, the youngest candidate in the race, and the moderate who is arguing that he can bring the country together.
Yeah, Sanders and Buttigieg seem to be the two folks that folks will be watching of the 11 candidates left in this Democratic field. The debate gets started at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. What else will you be watching for?
It's interesting, Tanya. You know, as you know, every now and then these debates can have big moments that make or break candidates. Recall that 4 years ago in the Republican debate, Governor Chris Christie went after Mark Rubio, and that pretty much started the end of Rubio's campaign. Yeah. So I think what's interesting in tonight's debate is this dynamic between the two winners out of Iowa, Sanders and Buttigieg. Will they attack each other? And what about Biden? You know, he had a dismal result out of Iowa. Polls suggest he's fading in New Hampshire. He's the guy who's been arguing all along that he's got the best chance of beating Trump. But to really make that argument persuasively, he's got to start winning. So there's a lot riding on this debate for him tonight. So it'll be interesting to see all of that tonight.
Yeah. Yeah. With a little bit of time that I have with you, you've spent a lot of time in New Hampshire talking to voters. What are you hearing from them about this field of candidates?
Well, I mean, I think what's interesting is that, you know, for months, people have been saying they like this field of candidates. But they're looking for a candidate who can beat Donald Trump. That's the most important thing. And sometimes that means that they're sort of struggling with this idea of voting their hearts versus voting for who they think the most electable candidate is. And the result is that a lot of folks are struggling to make up their minds right up until the last minute. We certainly saw that in Iowa. And right now, as we mentioned, it looks like that contest between Sanders and Buttigieg. But New Hampshire is famous for last-minute surprises, so it will be interesting to see what they deliver on Tuesday.
We definitely will be watching tonight and on Tuesday. That's Anthony Brooks, senior political reporter for WBUR. Thank you so much, Anthony.
My pleasure, Tanya.
Well, let's turn now to a competition that ends this Sunday. You might remember this 1983 top 10 hit by Thomas Dolby. Today, in addition to performing and composing, Dolby is professor of music for new media at Johns Hopkins Peabody Institute in Baltimore. And he has these thoughts on this year's Oscar nominees for Best Original Score and the long tradition from which they come.
Hollywood film scoring is an art form that's over a century old. When experimental films were first shown in the late 1800s, audiences were terrified by the spectral nature of the shadowy, flickering faces on the screen. A little soothing music calmed and comforted the crowd, and had the added benefit of drowning out the sound of that noisy, clanking film projector mounted right in the middle of the audience. In 1920, inventor Lee DeForest began to develop a commercially viable method of striping a soundtrack right onto the same film strip as the movie. No one seemed very interested, but then the Warner Brothers used the technology in The Jazz Singer in 1927, and the film was a huge hit, prompting the Hollywood studios to realize that now they would only have to pay the band once instead of every night. Despite that early tactic to screw over us musicians, motion pictures have become home to a succession of wonderful composers and some of the finest instrumental music since the classical era. Early orchestral scores like Max Steiner's King Kong in 1933 favoured Wagner's leitmotif technique, where a tune is assigned to each character, matching every on-screen action with its symphonic counterpart. These days, that's derisively referred to as Mickey Mousing. At the end of the 20th century, film scores tended to move away from this type of direct synchronization. It's no longer cool to tell audiences how to feel. A current A-list composer like Hans Zimmer, who wrote Gladiator and 12 Years a Slave, often sounds as if he's describing the arc and destiny of the characters, telling their backstory rather than enhancing their individual gestures and expressions. John Williams' scores embody all the triumphs and clichés of 20th century film music. This year's Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker sees the recycling of familiar themes. But what's most striking about this series finale is the gorgeous, quieter moments, such as Destiny of a Jedi, into which Williams weaves his longtime favourite Binary Sunset theme. This is Williams' ninth Star Wars score, going right back to the first film in 1977, for which he won the Best Score Oscar. So don't be surprised if he gets the award this year to bookend his remarkable achievements throughout the series, not forgetting the diversity of his other scores like Schindler's List and Harry Potter. When you hire Randy Newman to compose your music, what do you get? Randy Newman music. Melodic, delightful, and warmly human. Randy's been involved in literally hundreds of movie and TV projects and has won two Best Song Oscars. In Marriage Story, the Adam Driver Scarlett Johansson divorce saga, he once again delivers precisely what we expect from him. And it's pretty soppy and sentimental. Not really my cup of tea, but I've got to hand it to Randy. He's got longevity. I am a fan, however, of Thomas Newman, cousin to Randy, nephew of Lionel, and son of the great mid-century film composer Alfred Newman, collectively the most celebrated family in Oscar history. Thomas, you may recall, wrote The Shawshank Redemption, which is a seminal piece of scoring. This year's nominee, 1917, is a gripping slice of the First World War. And the highlight for me is this magnificent and terrifying sequence in the burning ruins of a cathedral. 1917 is wall-to-wall music, and overall this is a score that has little light and shade, lacking the feel-good factor of Shawshank. There's plenty to feel good about in Little Women, a charming update of the classic novel with a pretty score by 2018's Oscar winner Alexandre Desplat. He's a quirky and inventive composer, but this is not him at his best. I'm not going to be able to do justice to Hilde Guðnadóttir's last name, but she's part of a new genre of Nordic noir composers, along with last year's winner Ludvig Göransson and the now deceased Johan Johansson. Her music for Joker features broody unison symphonic chants, almost like plain song. The cellos and basses often sound like they're being played with a piece of tree bark instead of a bow, but it totally works. Last year, Hilde also scored the remarkable HBO series Chernobyl, which blurs the line between music and sound design. Joker is a startling re-examination of the Batman canon, and Hilde avoids the gothic bravado of her predecessors Danny Elfman and Hans Zimmer. Her raw, unfiltered score points to a future of smaller orchestras and more intimate psychoacoustic soundtracks. So I'm going to give my professorial nod to Joker. Not because it's 20 years since a woman won the Best Score Oscar, but because it reminds us that film music can be so darn weird and wonderful.
That's musician and professor Thomas Dolby on his pick for this year's Oscar for Best Original Score. Our piece was produced by NPR's Tom Cole.
The first jobs report of the year is stronger than economists expected. Employers added 225,000 jobs in January, according to the Labor Department. Wages also rose, and unemployment also ticked up just slightly, up to 3.6%. Let's take a look with Michael Regan. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hey, Mike, welcome back.
Hi, Peter.
So economists thought we were going to get 160,000 new jobs in January. It was a lot more than that. Why was this report so much better than they thought?
Well, you know, it's hard to say exactly because these estimates that we quote are a compilation of a few dozen economist estimates. But one thing that a lot of economists are talking about is simply how warm a month January was. And that allowed for strength in jobs that occur outdoors, specifically construction. There were about 44,000 construction jobs added in the month. And that's very unusual for a typically cold month like January. One other wild card I think is worth mentioning is it's hard to say exactly how companies responded to the phase one trade deal that was reached between the U.S. and China last year. So I think that's kind of a wild card that might be in the mix a little bit too.
Yeah, I'm looking at the manufacturing jobs numbers down again, 12,000. Did that stand out to you?
Yeah, it's typical weakness the last few months in manufacturing. I guess the hope is that eventually that turns around if there is further closure on the trade deal, but certainly another weak month for manufacturing.
And it might continue to be because, of course, there is concern about Boeing and its temporary decision to halt the production of the 737 MAX airplane. Will that affect suppliers? That's a question. Also, a big question mark hanging over the global economy is the coronavirus. Of course, China buys a lot of stuff from the United States. What about warning signs on that front?
So there have been a slew of companies that have come out and warned investors that their sales and profits will definitely be hurt from the virus, either because, as you say, they sell products in China or they import products from China, and a lot of those factories are closed down. So we know that at least in the short term on sales and profits, there's going to be a big hit to a lot of companies. As far as jobs, as of yet, there hasn't really been any big announcements of layoffs. I think that is a risk to keep an eye out for, especially if more cases crop up in the U.S. and suddenly people get a little nervous about going out to restaurants or malls or movie theaters. But you know, knock on wood, we're not at that phase now. And with any luck, we won't get there.
There was another thing in this report that I wanted to ask you about, a little bit different. This month, for the first time, the Labor Department is including same-sex couples when it counts the number of married workers. Now, it doesn't look like that's going to change the unemployment rate at all, but why the change, and what do you think the data could tell us?
Well, the main reason for the change is that the Supreme Court did rule that same-sex marriages were legal. As far as what the data adds to this report, all it does is lump same-sex married couples into the rest of the married couples. So it doesn't sort of get granular into the jobless rate or anything like that among same-sex couples.
2020 census will also include a checkbox for same-sex married or unmarried couples. So some progress being made there on that front. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, thanks so much for your time. Have a good weekend.
You too, Peter. Thank you.
Okay, we've all wondered about it. You know, those love scenes in movies. They seem so real, so intimate. It's sometimes easy to forget these folks are professional actors. Their job is to make it look real. But what exactly goes into making it real while also maintaining boundaries, especially in the wake of the Me Too movement? Well, there's actually a job for that, and it's in demand. They're called intimacy directors, and just recently, HBO announced it would hire intimacy coordinators for all of its productions. Joining us now to explain more is Broadway mainstay and intimacy director for plays like the critically acclaimed Slave Play, Claire Wharton. Welcome, Claire.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Okay, it sounds like you're part director, part counselor, part artistic director. Is that accurate? How do you describe your job to people?
I would say more that we're part advocate, part liaison, and part movement coach expert, in that part of our role is advocating for actors and making sure that what they're doing as part of their job is something that they maintain agency over their body and that they're consenting to at all levels. And we're also there to help the whole production team liaise when we're doing scenes of nudity or intimacy or sexuality, and to like let the conversation move across the whole team. And we're also there to help craft those physical stories, as we say, those moments, so that it looks real, but in fact we're not actually doing sex acts on stage or screen.
This is interesting. This idea of conversations about what's happening in the moment is across all of the folks who are part of this process and production. What was it like before this role became a regular thing in Hollywood?
It just didn't happen, really. A lot of it was just a kind of often a void of conversation. And so a lot of our work has been to understand what conversations we should be having, who should be having them, and how do we build a structure and a set of approach or protocol so that everyone knows how it's going to go. It makes it more efficient, and it means that what we need to be knowing and thinking about gets done ahead of time.
Claire, this is amazing because I think many of us already thought that this was these were protocols that were already in place.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of the most frequent questions I get when I explain what I do is, wait, we didn't have that already? Or then why didn't we have that already? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, a lot of it's just kind of we don't know what we don't know. Right. And then when we know it, everyone's like, well, what do we do about it? So it just took a group of us coming together to be like, okay, we see this this problem. We see these gaps where people are getting hurt because there is a lack of structure or understanding. So let's build something to give that structure, to fill that gap.
You are also a fight director. That's someone mm-hmm. that coordinates and facilitates fights we see on film and stage. But I'm really wondering, in the scope of what you were talking about actors and their safety, with a sex scene, it's also about power. So that's being vulnerable and authentically depicting an intense emotion at the same time. How do you begin to work with an actor specifically to elicit a good yet safe performance?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that also comes up in our fight work. But interestingly, like we as a society have very different relationship with violence than we do with sex and intimacy. And I think the difference in the intimacy work is that we are looking at the physical safety and respect, but we're also looking at psychological and emotional safety. So again, really, it's about building a structure for the actors at the beginning. We have a little physical kind of ritual that opens up the work each time called tapping in and tapping out, which lets them kind of step into this, great, now we're going to be professionals working together and creating a story together. We have the conversations about what is the story we're telling. It matters that we know what the story is before we start telling it. That way, not only are we creating something that's specific and fits with the play or the film we're doing, but it also helps our actors to know that we're doing this because of the story, not for personal gratification. Mm-hmm. And it's can seem a little a loose description, but really I do a lot of like holding the space so that feelings that come up, conversations, their own particular stories, they're able to manage and work through and decide what becomes part of their work and what doesn't. So it's really about like checking in on all three of those levels, physical, psychological, and emotional, to make sure that we're creating something that's healthy for them to do and sustainable, especially if we're talking about theatre and we're going to be doing 3 months, 6 months, a year's run. Is it sustainable to do that?
Yeah, I mentioned that you were the intimacy director for Slave Play, which was written by Jeremy O'Harris. And you won an award for that work. And I bring this up because, without giving away spoilers to the folks who are listening, this play really deals with racial trauma through mm-hmm. the lens of interracial relationships. And we learn that during that play, there's sort of a form of sex therapy. Can you walk me through how you even begin to prepare actors specifically in those roles? As you mentioned, they're doing it night after night for several weeks at a time. And did they have to also unpack not only the intimacy part of it, but some of their thoughts around race and sex as well with you?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, our director, Robert O'Hara, did an incredible job of creating the space right at the beginning for, you know, there's going to be difficult conversations. You know, this is going to feel close to many people, and we're going to make space for that, and we're going to have to talk about it as we create it. And so really, for me, it's about my job is to help to craft the story. And take, you know, the director's input and the actor's input of their own characters and the work they do. And with that, creating that structure so that they can step in, but also step out and leave it at the theater.
You know, I mentioned the Me Too movement earlier. And so it has me thinking, why now? Why is there such what seems like just an explosion of want and needs from many of these production houses for intimacy coordinators? Why do you think it is?
I think it's a little bit of an enlightenment that we've gone through. And it wasn't that actors just started speaking up because they've been speaking up for years. It's that those in power finally started or were made to listen.
Why is it important for the audience to know that this is the work that's happening behind the scenes as they take in these movies and these plays and they see these intimate scenes that are for the purpose of the larger story that they're consuming?
When actors are incredibly confident in what's happening on stage in a scene of sex or intimacy, that is something that can be read kind of viscerally by an audience. And right now where we are in the world and this epidemic of sexual assault that we're in and this awareness, what often happens to an audience when a scene of sex begins on stage is straight away that question goes, oh, are those actors going to be okay? Is this all right? Mm. And if they're not sure, they tend to leave the story and sit and worry about that. If they can read with their bodies the actor's confidence level and that the actors are completely okay with what's happening, they get to relax and actually go deeper into the story. So we're actually shifting the audience's receiving experience of watching theater or film. But I also think what it's doing, that this conversation is happening, is that we are reinforcing the need in any kind of interaction, physical interaction, the need for conversation and consent and agency and individuals' agency over their own body, and that coercion and persuasion and power dynamics are unacceptable when it comes to sexual interaction. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, and we learn as a nation, you know, we've become very influenced by the entertainment that we watch, TV, film, and theater. And so it is a way to reach a large populace, and not only have that conversation about consent and allowance, but also so we can actually start diversifying the stories that we're telling so that we're not just always seeing, a white, cis, heteronormative, male-driven power dynamic in our sex, but that we can actually open up the conversation about intimacy, about sex, about the kinds of people that have it with each other and on their own, and start really representing the world out there so that that conversation can begin in a fully inclusive way.
That's Broadway Intimacy Director Claire Warden. Thank you for this fascinating discussion.
You're welcome. I'm so glad to be able to talk to you about it.
Earlier this month, Mexican officials discovered the body of a second murdered activist who worked at a monarch butterfly reserve in the mountains of Michoacán. When NPR reported on this recently, a line in the story caught our attention. Illegal logging for clandestine avocado groves had something to do with the murders. And of course, we wanted to learn more about that. Joining us now is Eduardo Moncada. He's a political science professor at Barnard College. He is writing a book in part about extortion in Michoacán. Professor, welcome to Hero Now.
Thank you.
And how are the cartels working to control avocado production in Mexico?
Well, for several years now, the cartels have been diversifying their portfolios to still include drugs, but to include a range of other otherwise legal economies, including the avocado sector. Avocados represent a major source of income in the state of Michoacán in Mexico. And as such, they've been mobilizing to try and capture money from that sector. And they do that in a variety of ways. On the one hand, they engage in extortion of producers and transporters and packers of avocados. And in other instances, they also try to take over lands that are used to produce avocados so that they themselves become the informal owners of those lands and can profit from the sale of avocados.
And are you familiar with this butterfly reserve and why the cartels would be interested in that land specifically?
Well, the land in this particular case represents obviously a valuable resource. On the one hand, in terms of being able to produce more agricultural goods that like avocados, but also the timber and the wood in this particular type of land is valuable. This is part of the broader sort of portfolio, including illegal harvesting of timber there.
And what is driving them to diversify beyond drugs?
Politics. If you think back to the reign under President Calderón in Mexico, when the war on drugs in Mexico began, in addition to the large amount of violence that that unleashed, it also fragmented many of the cartels from a handful of hegemons to a number of smaller cartels. And in order to survive and thrive in that kind of context, cartels began to diversify their portfolios in a way to try and gain resources.
Calderón's war on the cartels started when he was elected back in 2006, so they've likely been diversifying for a while now. But what is it like for these growers who are caught in the middle? I assume it's just like anything else in confrontation with the cartels. You have to say yes. You have to go along with what they are asking you to do. So how are they responding?
It is indeed a very difficult situation. I think it's important to underscore, though, that for many of these growers, initially, at least in some of the places where I've been doing research, many of them welcomed the drug cartels initially because they were providing them with services that the state had failed to do so for years and years. Things like basic security for themselves, for their lands, for their products. Cartels would provide this in return for a tax, something that the state hadn't done effectively or hadn't done at all in many of these parts of Mexico. Over time, the cartels became much more predatory toward these communities and stopped really providing those types of services and simply kept charging those extortion fees. And that's when you saw a very difficult situation for producers in this part of Mexico.
Well, you know, I can just imagine people are listening to this who are thinking to themselves, wait a minute. I love avocados, and when I go to the grocery store and I buy one, I have no idea what it takes to produce these and that the cartels might be involved somewhere in this supply chain. So are you able to draw a direct line from American demand for avocados to what's happening in Michoacan?
No, I don't think we can draw a direct line. And I don't think the American consumer should sort of think about their consumption of avocados as somehow contributing to the drug cartels. I think it becomes much more complicated than that, in part because not all the avocados coming from Mexico have some involvement from the cartels. Certainly some do, but it's difficult to know which ones are and which ones aren't. And on the other hand, much like any commodity that we purchase, from the phones that we use to the computers that we're reliant on, those commodity chains kind of move back and forth between the legal and the illegal and the criminal and the formal. And avocados aren't an exception to that.
Makes you wonder about limes, peppers, lettuce, a bunch of other stuff too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Michoacán in Mexico, in addition to being one of the main sources of avocados for the United States, is also one of the main sources of berries. Blueberries, strawberries, blackberries, and many of these communities that produce berries are also being taxed by drug cartels and have also had to deal with these issues. So one could also make the parallel there.
Well, you have given us something to think about, for sure. Eduardo Moncada, political science professor at Barnard, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.